My name is Ike Friesen, and I was raised and born in a little town south of Winnipeg here named Plum Coulee. And my daddy died when I was 2 years old. My mother raised five children. The oldest one at the time was 14, and we were on the farm, and we had a pretty rough going there then. The Hungry 30s set in. And my mother worked the farm with us kids. My oldest brother was by this time getting a little older, and the war broke out. And by this time I was 19 years old, and I joined the Army. It was simple as that. And in June 1940, I came to Winnipeg. It was only my second time I ever seen Winnipeg. I went and I joined the Army, and I joined 18th Manitoba Reconnaissance. And from we went to the Robinson Building, and from the Robinson Building the 18th went to Shiloh. We took my advanced training in Shiloh, and I took my my basic training was in Shiloh. My advanced training, and from there we went to Borden. I took my advanced training in Borden, and then the Winnipeg, by this time it was 1941, and we heard the Winnipeg Grenadiers were coming back from FICA. And I got reboarded, and I was told I wouldn't be able to go overseas. So I decided, well, if I can't go overseas, I might as well get out. So I talked to one of the medical officers, and he says to me, he says, there's some good jobs in Canada. You can stay in, and you can be get into a depot somewhere, and you can get a good job. So I got sent back to Winnipeg, and I was going through an NCO course, and I was going to be an instructor for the recruits. And then the Winnipeg Grenadiers came back, and I heard about them, and I heard they were not too fussy who they were taking. So I went and seen my commanding officer and asked if I could get my category raised. And there was no problem there. The next day I was an A1 man, and I went to the Robinson Building again, where the Grenadiers were housed when they came back from Jamaica, and next day we went overseas. Next morning we went on, got on the train, and we went to Vancouver. That was pretty hectic. When we did get to Vancouver, they didn't give us any breakfast because they said they'd serve us breakfast on the ship. And when we did get to Vancouver, I guess it was a little later than they figured. It was around noon hour. And by this time, hadn't fed us breakfast or lunch. And they said you'd get fed on the ship. And by the time we got fed on the ship, at about 4 or 5 o'clock, where we got is tripe and boiled onions. Well, then hell broke loose. We had a big riot on the ship. The ship just about didn't go sail that time because they just about didn't have anybody to sail. But it was the advance of the guards that were there that closed the gates and they wouldn't let the boys go through, so they finally got the boys all back on the ship. That we did sail, and we took off early that evening.
Did you have any idea at that point where you were heading?
We didn't have no idea where we were going. All we were told that we were going to the South Pacific, and we had no idea where we were going. And when the ship did leave, it just went outside the harbor, past the breakwaters, and it anchored for the night. And then early in the morning, it sailed. Mm-hmm. And our first lecture that we got on the ship was that we were heading into enemy territory, and that we would be sailing under blackout, and we would be sailing under war precautions, and we would be treated as such. So this is the only thing we knew. And we were on the ship, I guess, I don't know what time we were. When we left here some date in October. I think it was around about the 18th of October when we did leave Canada, and we didn't get back into Hong Kong until around first week in November, on the 9th or 11th of November, I think it was, when we got to Hong Kong. So we were on the ship quite a while. And even then, we had no idea that the Japs, that we were that close to war with the Japs. When we got to Hong Kong, a lot of us were quite green. Mind you, I had been in the Army for a little better than a year. I wasn't that green to the Army, but I was green to this type of Asiatic life that we went into. I had never seen a British garrison in my life before, never left Canada. In fact, I hardly seen the lights, bright lights of Winnipeg a year before that. And what struck me most, what struck me the hardest, and it'll always stick with me, is when we went to Shamshipo, the first lecture that we got from the British commander. And I was a transport driver, and he came out specially, and he said to the, called us lorry drivers, he's now especially to you lorry drivers, he says, one thing I want to tell you, that if you're driving down the streets in the city of Kelowna, that if you hit a Chinaman, you look back in your rearview mirror, and if he's still kicking, you back that truck up and run over him again. He says, because if you send him to the hospital, it's going to cost you your hospital bill. If you kill him, it's going to cost you $5 for burial. It was as simple as that. This is how much the Chinese coolie's life was worth in Hong Kong at the time. And it really hit me hard right from the start.
I'd like to stop just for a minute and go back. Your name is Mennonite. Were you raised as a Mennonite?
I was raised as a Mennonite, yes. I was raised as a Mennonite, and I never really did believe in the Mennonite religion myself. Mm-hmm. I always kind of did buck it, and I always did fight it. Same as the youth today, they're bucking, they want to do their thing. Mm-hmm. Well, I had that idea when I was a kid 40 years ago. I wanted to do my own living. And mind you, we didn't have the opportunity then that you have today. And I was always called by my family and by my relatives, I was the wild one. And when I came back from overseas, I never did go back to the Mennonite religion. I was never a Mennonite, really, by heart. I didn't agree with their church. I didn't agree with the way they... their teachings.
And I was just interested because I wondered why you would come to join the Army in the first place. If you'd been a strong Mennonite, you probably wouldn't have.
This was the point. I was classed as the wild one. Tell you the truth, I was in my home area there, right from, well, let's put it this way, from Rosenfeld right up to Morden. I think I was about the third one that joined in that area, as a Mennonite. I mean, I would say as a Mennonite boy. And I knew there was others that joined, but they were in different denominations. They were either English, or they were some other foreigners, you know, like, say, Italians and stuff like that. So some of those boys joined before me. But as a Mennonite, I think I was only the third one that did join from that area. And after that, there was quite a few more that did go in. In fact, a lot of them did go in.
Getting back to your story about the... I was interested because I wondered if that had colored your sort of reaction to the British attitude towards...
No, that. Not really. Because I never did really believe in... I hate to hurt that dog. I mean, I wouldn't ever slap that dog. I mean, this is just my... inside feeling about living things. I don't believe in this really. But yet I could have went and killed a Jap. I would have had no problem. Mind you, I don't know if I ever did or not. I didn't do it hand by hand anyway. If I did shoot at one, I don't know if I ever hit him. But I would have had no problem because I was built up to this time, you know, to this point.
Yeah. Who was the commanding officer in Hong Kong at this time?
Old Sutcliffe was our commander. Now, the British commander, I think, was... No, Holmes was the commander of the Rifles, and Sutton was the commander of the Winnipeg Grenadiers. And as far as the British commander, I don't even know who he was. I heard his name mentioned so many times, but I wasn't too interested of remembering his name.
You had trouble with the transport, didn't you? Like, the trucks didn't get there.
Our trucks never got there, because our trucks were... Our supplies never got there. In fact, our supplies, I think, the rumors were that they were sunk. Other rumors were that they were turned back and they were unloaded in Manila. But we never knew where they disappeared. But all we know is they were loading them when we left Vancouver. Because the freighter was in there and they were loading supplies and transports on the other, just the opposite dock is what we were loading.
How did you go about getting trucks when you...
Well,
when you got there.
What we did is we just confiscated and stole every civilian truck that was available. Like when we first got there, it was only about 3 weeks from the time we got there to the time the war broke out, maybe a little better. And what our outfit did is we went into the town, or to the Hong Kong government, and hired civilian trucks. Like, for instance, I was a transport driver, and I was supposed to go to the ration depot and get a load of rations for the kitchen. Well, there'd be a Chinese driver in a civilian truck, and I would get into the truck, and I'd be the coal driver, he'd be the driver, and I'd just tell him where to go. And this went on, and this would have went on even if we would have got our trucks. If we would have got our own vehicles, from what I understand, we would have still have had Chinese people to do the driving for us, and all we would have been doing is sitting on the side and telling them where to go and what to do. The Chinese labor was so cheap, they were getting 10 cents a day, Hong Kong money, which is less than 2.5 cents in Canadian money a day. I think the exchange was 4.65 to our dollar. So, and in order to give these Chinese some work, and I think this is what it was doing, I mean, we had little batmen in our huts. The hut I was staying in, there was about 40 of us, and we had three boys in there. They would make our bed. They would wake us up in the morning after reveille, and they would shave you in bed before you really got your eyes open. And then when you were finished shaving you, you'd grab your towel and run for the shower, and when you got back from the shower, your bed would be made and your clothes would be out for the day to what you would be. And we paid them $1 a week.
Pretty good.
And they were making good money. They were making better than average because everybody in the hut was paying them this. And they were big shots. They were making money galore.
How was the civilian attitude towards the Canadian forces and the British forces when you were there?
The civilians were very good to us. The civilians in Shamshipo, I mean, mind you, we were out for a good time, and we did have a good time in the 3 weeks we were there. The pubs were good. Their night life is quite fast there, and I think the nightlife in Shamshipo could show Canada a few tricks that they haven't even seen yet. We had a ball. The girls were nice. But as far as the people themselves, I think they'd sell their own grandmother for 10 cents. Even when we went up in the hills, our kitchen boy, he was up in there with one of the batteries up in the platoons up in the hills, and the second day they were there, they shot him just without... No, not batting an eye, for the simple reason they caught him spying for it. He was flashing signals across the bay to the Japs. And this is what you had to watch for, we call the fifth columnist.
There was a lot of that, too.
And there was all of it. I mean, you couldn't trust any of them. And really, you can blame them. What you seen going on in Hong Kong, I mean, any promise to them was a light of hope to them, which is better than they were living. Because say at 12 o'clock, you were coming home from a pub 12 o'clock at night, and this was in December, And your nights aren't that warm in Hong Kong. I mean, they might be warm as far as degrees is concerned, but 60 degrees in a damp climate like Hong Kong, I mean, it's pretty cold. Especially sleeping on the sidewalk. You couldn't walk on the sidewalk. You'd be stepping over sleeping bodies. So you just stepped off the curb into the pass off the gutter, and you would walk on the road because your vehicles weren't that plentiful there, especially at that time of the night. And you just walk on the road. There's no sense walking on the sidewalk because you'd be tripping over the Chinaman who's sleeping. They'd all be sleeping on the sidewalk. It would be just like a big row in a barrack block. In some sections, you couldn't even hardly step. And this is the fact. So anything was better to them. Any promise, any light that would flicker of hope was better than nothing to them.
Better than what they had at the time.
You better believe it, it was.
Where were you when the fighting took place? Like when the fighting started, when the hostilities actually broke out?
Well, the night before the fighting really started, we all went to the island. And some, I don't think they got them all there. Some guys still were in Sham Shui Po, and I think a few of the guys that were in the can behind bars from the riot the week before. I mean, we had the big riot in the Sun Sun. You probably heard about that one, eh? There's quite a few of them that got thrown in the can. And when the bombs fell Sunday morning, it just rattled the gates in the old guardhouse. And it scared the living Jesus out of some of those prisoners that were in there. And Steve D'Arrow was the military police sergeant. And after he kind of shook himself after the first bomb fell in Sham Shui Po, I think he opened all the gates and just let the guys go. And they got across the island somehow. But by this time, we were all over there. It was just more or less the rear guys, like the guys that were guarding the camp that were still left in Sham Shui Po, and that wasn't a very big number. And but the night before, the day before, we were told that we had a forced move and that we were going up in the hills. And I was stationed in Sham Shui Po. And I was under Major Hutchison, and I really never got into the real battle until about the 18th of the month, when Devil's Gap was overrun, when the A Company got taken prisoner. I think they got taken prisoner the 18th or the 19th of December, and this is when we got into the battle.
Devil's Gap is the part where they came over onto the island.
That's right. That was the cemetery was right below in the gap, right in the valley of Devil's Gap. And this is where they came over. And A Company was stationed there, and they got the blunt end of it. So they got the first part of it, and they got hit real hard.
And they were using the pillboxes.
They were using the pillboxes for their advantage. First of all, the pillboxes were so darn... this concrete that was used in the pillbox, one grenade would just blow them to powder. And our guys would go in there for cover for the pillboxes, and some Japanese guy, that soldier that had been on the island before, all he would do is go throw a grenade into the ventilator or the pillbox, and that was the end of the boys in the pillbox and the pillbox. It, all it is seen is a mess of powder. Yeah. Somebody made a real rake off from building them. And then in the first I heard about, then Major Hutchison got wounded. He got wounded on the 20th, no, yeah, about the 20th of December. And I was, Tugby was, Sergeant Major, was in charge of the company that I was with. And he says, the bombing is getting pretty heavy here and the shelling is getting pretty heavy. I think we better take off. So all we did is, instead of going further into town, we went further up the hill. And as we were going up the hill, the shelling was getting heavier and heavier. But anyway, we got into one of the vacant houses where some big shot American had been living. I think he was had evacuated, and we took refuge in the house. And then the next morning, that house got blown up, but we got out before the house got blown up. And then we went back down again, right into the valley. And then we were told that the war was over. And then they took us to the university grounds. We were told to head for the university grounds, and this is where we would, where they wanted us to congregate. And from there we went to Shamshipo. We had that big march from the university grounds. We had that big march to Shamshipo. And then we didn't stay in Shamshipo too long, and then they took us over to North Point. And we stayed.
Do you know what North Point was before the war?
A refugee camp that was built by the British for the refugees that were coming in from Canton. The Japanese were chasing them out from the interior of China.
So the conditions at North Point wouldn't have been the best in the world.
The conditions of North Point, are you probably, your partner, you probably see the conditions in North Point, because I imagine this Bill Ashton did display some of his pictures of North Point. They were back there in 1969, was it?
68.
They were back there, and that apparently that camp hasn't changed too much, and the refugees were still in there, and they were making a noodle factory out of it. They were making noodles. You see, against the fence there was big long strings of noodles, where they were making noodles out of it, and that camp was so darn flea and bug infested camp then when we were there that this is where we got all our diseases, right in North Point. This is where dysentery hit us real hard. The dysentery really knocked us for a loop. I went right down from 135 to right down to about 98 pounds. And it wasn't until we went to Japan. I never did regain that weight in Hong Kong. When we went to Japan and start working and started stevedoring is where I started getting my weight back. But then I only went up to about 105 pounds.
Where were the conditions worse as far as the treatment you got from the Japanese?
Oh, I think Shamshipo and North Point were the worst by far, because
when they first took you in.
When they first took us in, and the treatment in North Point was so bad because it was all new to us. Our bodies had to change over from our diet to their diet. Now, you take a normal Canadian diet and then go onto a Japanese or a Chinese diet, such as rice and greens, and not much of that, not near enough to even keep your bellies from growling, alone your vitamins. I mean, it was pretty bad, and this is where the diseases started, even your skin diseases. I mean, some guys had some real bad skin diseases, and your dysentery and your malaria came in. And then we went to Shamshipo, and then we got hit with diphtheria, and we were carrying them out there by like flies. And then they started a work party at Shamshipo. We were the airport that is now in Hong Kong. That hill we started to that mountain we started to flatten out by picking shovel.
Did you get paid?
No, we got paid nothing. One time we were told that we were supposed to get 10 cents a day, and some of them did get it, but a lot of them didn't get it. But the 10 cents a day didn't amount to beans, because the money that you did get, there was no place to spend it unless you had a little ring going, which there was quite a few of them. You had a little ring going, and the odd guy would make contact with the person outside and buy cigarettes and a few spices, like salt was a very desperate thing that everybody was craving for. And he'd get in a couple of pounds of salt and But other than that, there was nothing you could buy. The officers could. The officers had a little canteen of their own there for a while. But the men, no way.
Was there much bitterness about that? Yeah.
I don't think we had a good officer in that camp. As far as senior officers, a grenadier senior officer, there wasn't one that was worth blowing to hell. And I'm not kidding you. We had a few junior officers who were real good men. They were real top-notch men. They were men from the day they went over to the day they came back. But we never had a senior officer that was worth.
You would have been in Bardell's group?
No, I wasn't with Bardell's group. No.
As a transport man?
No, Bardell was transport in Jamaica.
In Jamaica,
yeah,
right.
King Hughes was the transport officer in Hong Kong. And King Hughes, he died here about a year ago. Mm-hmm. He was a freelance correspondent with the Free Press, I think, or with the Tribune, I think he was. And he wouldn't even pay his dues. Well, none of the officers in the Winnipeg Grenadiers are paying their dues. There's only one officer that's paying his dues right now that I know of, and that's McKechnie. And all the officers that are living in the Winnipeg Grenadiers, I think McKechnie is the only one that's paying his dues.
They were also in a different camp than you, weren't they?
They were in the same camp, but they were fenced off from us.
Yeah. Segregated from
they were segregated from us.
And did you still have to take your orders from them?
Well, we took our orders from our officers, and we took the orders from the Japanese, which made it bad. We'd get punished twice in a lot of cases. Our officers would, if we got caught, say we the guys did something real bad, where the Japanese would punish the whole camp, for instance. Then our officers would go and punish that guy, the individual guy. Cut his ration of rice off, or something like that, make things worse. And this is where the bitterness had come. Not only would they cut your rice off, they would take it for themselves. I mean, they were a bunch of real glutton group. There wasn't one of them. Even, what's his name, Colonel Chris, that took over when Sutcliffe died. He was looking for Colonel Christen, that's all. And then we had one guy there, he was in fair shape. He tried to do a few boys, and that was Captain Golden. He's now Major Golden. He was a half-decent guy. But he was overruled the minute he wanted to... the minute he stepped out of the line, of the officer's line, he was overruled, and there's not too much he could do. The only guy that ever did anything for us half-decent was our padre. And he had nothing but fights on his hand.
Who instituted the groups of five, was it? That was instituted to keep the men from escaping? Was that an officer's institution, or was that the Japanese?
Some of it was. Some of it was our own officers. But I think this was instituted by the Japanese. I think the Japanese contacted... or they made proposed this to our officers, that an officer would be made charge of so many men, and our officers would break it down to a smaller group, so the officers, they still made little companies out of the regiment so that the officers could control it better. And then the officer would give each sergeant maybe five men or six men, whatever they came out to. And this sergeant would have to account to this officer every day that his men were all accounted for. That, say, for instance, there was a break in North Point. Three guys went. Well, the officer that was in charge of those men, that officer, I think, got punished quite severely over it. But basically, he didn't know nothing. Those men, when they escaped, there was only very few people that knew about it. I slept in the same hut as the one guy did, and I didn't know about it. I had no idea. His brother was a very good friend of mine. And I had no idea.
Did you try at all to get out?
No. No, I never tried it. It was hopeless. There was no... Your color would give you away in the first place.
Yeah.
First of all, in China, wouldn't have, if you would have known if you would have known China at all, there would have been a hope in China maybe you could have got into the interior and escaped the Japanese there and with the Chinese helping you. But once you got to Japan, there was no hope for... Because your color, the minute those Japanese, they were so loyal to their country that the minute there was no white man. We used to, when we were in Niigata, it was one of the most northern seaports in Japan. And we walked to work about 4.5 to 5 miles every day. We walked it back and forth. And in those 3 years that we were in Japan, or almost 3 years, it was from 43 to 45. Spring of 43 till August 45. I never seen a white soul on the streets. There wasn't a white person. The only white person I ever seen in Japan was the Swedish or the International Red Cross members. Came into our camp one time to inspect it. And they didn't let them see nothing. They only went through one hut. Well, they made it quite clean, you know, but as far as food is concerned, I don't think there was much change in the food. Mm-hmm. But there's not too much. I don't think those people even got it out of the country. I don't think their report was even reached Geneva or wherever the reports went to before the war was over. I mean, it was all such a slow process that anything they reported... 2 years at the very most before the International Red Cross ever got a hold of it.
Did you get any Red Cross process while you were still in Hong Kong, in Sham Shui Po?
In Sham Shui Po, no, I can't remember getting a Red Cross parcel in Sham Shui Po. My first Red Cross parcel we got was in the camp, and that was the in the old camp. When we went to Niigata, the camp that we were supposed to go into wasn't finished. So they took us into a workman's camp, which was a two-story affair. Your upper and your lower flat. And it was quite crowded. In fact, we had about... Well, our sleeping space maybe was as big as one pillow. This is how close we would be sleeping together. And we were there for 3 months. And before we left those accommodations to our new built camp, we got a Red Cross parcel. And then when we did get to our new built camp, we were only in that camp when we moved late in the fall, and this was just around Christmas time. And the hut that we went into, that hut collapsed. And I think there was 4 guys or 5 guys died in that night in the collapse of the hut. It snowed so heavy, and those huts, they were built so flimsy, and they had these big, heavy European slates for roofing. And the weight collapsed the hut. And the guy that I lived with, or slept with, we'd been working, and we were fairly wet. In fact, we were almost soaking wet when we came home from work that night. And the only way to dry is to get under your blankets and dry your clothes during the night while you had them on. So we were sleeping quite close together, and there was one great big beam. I guess it was a 12 by 12 beam going right across the length of the hut, and it was spliced with two U-nails, like just a nail like this, and they would, each end was driven in, one on each side. And when that hut came down, that end of the beam hit my partner right in the neck, Joe Fury. And when I, in fact, when we were facing him, when I opened my eyes after the screaming was done, and well, the blood was just streaming out of his mouth, and his tongue was hanging out. And I had to nudge my neck a wee bit in order to get my head loose, and the beam never touched me. It just stopped right at the edge of his neck and just killed him dead. And the blood, I was soaked up with blood. My whole side, my shirt was all soaked with blood. And that blood did never come out of my shirt until the day I threw it away. I wore that shirt for 2 years after. Washed it with cold water, but the blood stains would never come out.
The temperature was a lot colder in Japan. Like, did they issue you better clothes?
Yeah, we do. They issued us what they call winter and summer uniforms. Their winter uniforms were of a quilted type. They were heavy. They were the same color khaki, and they were the breech type trousers. And they had rolled the putties. They themselves rolled the putties right from their boots right up to their knees. But we just laced our breech pants, and we didn't have the putties. And most of the time, we didn't have any shoes. I know one guy, a fellow named Carl Johnson. He went to work in a snowdrift one time, barefooted, and there was snow. There was 3 feet of snowdrifts on the road, which we plowed through, and he went barefooted to work. And when they got to work, they gave him a pair of these straw boots. This rice straw. Everything over there was made by straw. Their sacks, their bags, their boots, their hats. Everything was made by straw. And they gave him one of these straw boots, and I think he wore them for about 3 hours, and they fell off his feet. And we were pitching pig iron that day, and he was going barefoot all day long. He froze him, but it wasn't too cold.
Yeah.
He's moving around, but there was guys that froze their feet, and I know Harry Cameron. He got his he's got no toes. He's got shoes about this long. So all his toes are off.
Getting back just a little bit, I'm interested to know how they recruited the people to go to Japan.
From Shamshipu, I think it the doctor, I think Dr. Crawford, which was our senior medical doctor, a Canadian, I think he made up the list. And I think under his recommendation is what they took.
Were people anxious to get to Japan?
A lot of them were. I, for instance, was, yeah. I wanted to get out of Shamshipo because Shamshipo was a death trap. And from what I hear from some of the boys, that it didn't change too much even after a lot of us had left. It hadn't changed too much. They still had the work parties and all that stuff. We're in Japan. When once we got to Japan, we worked steady every day. We got 1 month, one day a month, we got for ourselves, and then half the time we would be put on a work party to go and we would go and get wood for so the kitchen could cook the rice. But I think Crawford was would make up the list for who's to, and I think the only list he made up is who was the healthiest of them. But I don't think he made up the list that who should go or shouldn't go. I think he just made up the list for the healthy ones.
And were your rations any better? Like you mentioned that you were able to steal food off the ships when you're...
Our rations improved in Japan, but not by that much. We got a little more. We got three times a day. And it was still vegetables and rice, mostly greens. Potato tops and carrot tops would be our greens. Very few potatoes, you know, sweet potato. And, but then, once we got to work in the Murutsuk dockyards, this work party I was on, we started off with 23, and I think we ended up with about 18 when the war was over. And the guards that were there were there pretty well. There wasn't too much shifting of the guards, of the civilian guards. Like once the army guards took us to the dockyards, they wouldn't stay there. They would turn us over to the civilian guards, like the civilian, we'd call them foremen here, work foreman, and those civilian guards would be in charge of us, and they were responsible for us as far as escaping is concerned and all, and the amount of work that was done. And they were there most of the time. They didn't change that often, and we got to know them quite well. Some of them were quite reasonable to talk to, and some were not that good. And we'd get a little racket going with the odd guard, and with the odd worker that was working alongside of us. We'd get a little racket going. We still had a little bit of money from Shamshipo, and which was Japanese-issued currency. And he'd get cigarettes in for us. And then cigarettes was our main thing. After we got working on the docks, cigarettes was our main thing. Because as far as salt, stuff like that, as we could steal. And we'd steal plenty of it. Mind you, we wouldn't do too much sharing with it. Like if we stole a handful of salt, we wouldn't give it to our buddy. We'd sell it to him. We'd sell it to him for a cigarette or something. And then a cigarette would be worth a ration of rice. And if you had cigarettes, you had money. Because cigarettes was money. And that was the means of currency in the camp, as far as we were concerned, is cigarettes. And if you were a little hungry and you had a cigarette, well, you'd just go down the hallway and you'd holler, "I got a cigarette for a ration of rice." And the guy would say, "Well, I'll give you my tomorrow noon's ration." And you'd give him the cigarette, and then the next day at noon you would go and you'd collect his ration of rice. And this was going back and forth right along, and the guy with consequences, he would either resell half of that cigarette to another guy, maybe get a ration of rice for only half a cigarette, or he'd go without a ration of rice. And this is the guys that didn't come back. It's the ones that were selling food left and right. And then when we start stealing, well, then salt was cigarettes. Well, anything was stolen. I stole a fellow named Joe Squark and myself from Dauphin. Him and I, we'd taken a 14-pound smoked salmon one time. We worked on salmon. Joe says to me, Ike, I think we should take one in, eh? And I says, "Well, how the heck are you going to get it in?" Well, he says, "You want to help? Two of us can get it in." And it was quite a warm day that day. And we put it in the sleeve in one of our jackets. We tied the end of our sleeve and we rolled the jacket so the tied end wasn't noticeable. And sure enough, when we got in the camp, they searched us that night. But the guy that was beside me, he was carrying the rice bucket that we took our rations of rice in to work. And it was a big wooden bucket. And he carried it, and I says to him, I says, "No sense hanging on to that bucket." I says, "Set it in front of you." So he just took one step forward and set the bucket down. He stepped back into rank, and the Japanese seen this. So as soon as he put the bucket down, I picked him to my jacket there. And I stood to attention, and they searched us, and they never searched that jacket and the bucket, that empty bucket. And when they dismissed us, we just picked up my jacket and walked into it. But don't tell me I was sweating.
Did you ever have to spend any time in the hole?
Yeah, I did 14 days in the hole.
What was that for?
For stealing.
You got caught.
Stealing rice.
Rice, of all things.
Rice, yeah. Well, rice was our basic food. I mean, we knew this. And when we worked on rice, we would... you'd go to the kitchen where the guys were cooking up rice. And we'd make little deals with them. Like those kitchen staff, most likely they got all they wanted. But they would make deals with you. So you'd give them a couple of cups of rice and you'd say, "Well, I'll cook it up for you, but I want half of it." So you'd give him a couple of cups of dry rice and he would cook it up for you. And he would take his share out of it and he'd bring it back to you. Cooked. Which, that was our main diet anyway. It was bread. Let's put it this way. I mean, the rice there was like had bread here. That was our basic diet.
Did you get polished rice or unpolished
rice? We preferred the unpolished. But lots of times, most of the time, we got the polished rice. The unpolished rice was much better, really.
More sustained.
More, and tasted better. Because this is what we lacked. We were lacking this taste all the time because it, all our food, there was no spices in it. It was always cooked without salt and no other spices, no pepper. And we got a hold of garlic. The crew that worked at the dockyard, we got a hold of pretty near anything. You name it, we could steal it. Maybe it'd take a while before the ship would come in or before you'd get into a warehouse where it was in. But eventually you would get it. You name it. We could steal. Powdered milk. And did you talk to any of the boys that drank that de-icing fluid yet? Well, we had five guys die 10 days before the war was over in our camp. This one day, it was kind of a bitter day too, because it's kind of wet and sleet and snowing a bit. No, it wasn't snowing either. It must have been raining because it was in July, 10 days before the war was over. One of the workmen, we called them honchos. This is what their foremen were called. So this honcho is Japanese guard or foreman, you want to call it. He came up and he says he wanted four men to unload a barge of barrels. And he took us from away from the main dock and across the railroad track. Across the road was the warehouse, and the other side of the warehouse was this river. And this river was the means of their transportation of these heavy barges that would be loaded when the ships came in. And their barges would be going up the river to other ports. And this barge was docked in the back of the warehouse there, and it was loaded with barrels, 45 gallon drums. And I think there was about somewhere around 40 of them down there. So we unloaded four of them. And they were pretty heavy rolling up the plank. The barges are pretty deep and then up the dock. So they was pretty heavy. So this honcho, he says, he was going to go and get some more men. While he was gone, we broke one of the barrels. And the first thing, when this was our big habit, the first thing what we worked on is anything to eat. This is the first thing that came into our mind.
Yeah.
What's in those barrels? So we broke one, and that's whiskey. Holy hallelujah. First thing, we started to drink the darn stuff. And then the other guys came, and some of the guys filled their, they had their canteens, and they filled their canteens up with stuff. We start drinking it. By 3 o'clock that afternoon, when we finished loading the bars, quite a few of our guys were drunk. So by 4 o'clock, by time, and we went in early that night because we'd finished. We were promised that if we unloaded that barge that day, they'd bring us, take us in. We'd finish work, and we went in quite early that day and night. But on the way in, we ended up carrying three guys. They were so drunk they couldn't make it. So we more or less carried them in, half walk and half carry on your shoulder. And when we got into camp, in the meantime, it's kind of funny, you know. In the meantime, when they were unloading, after he got the rest of the boys to unload these barges, old Sebison is one of the honchos. He come to Joe Squirk and a fellow named Roland Doobie and myself, and he says, "There's an ox cart." Everything was like locally around the yards. Everything was done by ox cart. He says, "There's a cart full of rice." And he says, "I don't want you three guys to unload it." And they unloaded the rice in the same warehouse that a week before we had unloaded a ship full of powdered milk. And we, quite cagey at this stuff, the guys that would be on the top of the pile stacking the cases of milk, he would always leave room for, if he ever wanted to get back, or if he ever got back in that warehouse, that he could get out a can of milk quite simply. So Joe says, "I've arranged a case of milk there." He says, "It's not hard to get at." He says, you climb up on those cases, and he says, you unlock that window. And then after we were finished unloading the cart, and the window where we was just by an outside biffy. And if we got on the outside biffy, on the roof of the outside biffy, we'd come in that window. So I went up and unlocked that window. And then when we were finished unloading that cart of rice, they took us back to the other crew, and then we all asked the foreman if we could go to the can. And he kind of, he gave me a slap in the mouth, I think it was, for because I was the last one to ask. He said, well, you three want to go in to the can at the same time. He wouldn't usually allow this. But by the time I got there, Joe already was in the window. He climbed the roof and he got into the window. And he was throwing these cans of milk out already. And we had these little Red Cross can openers. You probably have seen them. They usually come, these little metal ones. They come in the packs, K-rations in the Army mostly now. And we had some of them from our previous Red Cross parcel. So we carried them on with us all the time. So we opened these cans of milk and we took our socks off and we filled our socks full of powdered milk and tied them between our crutch and walked in. We must have had, between the three of us, we must have had about 3-4 cans of milk. And when we got in, that was the first thing we did. We mixed up a batch of milk and we drank milk. And as soon as Roland had taken a glass of milk or a cup of milk, he just threw up. He started to throw up, and it was green and purple and you name it. And by this time, we were starting to throw up. And we got sick, and the guys all laughed at us that we couldn't take it. And it wasn't 2 hours later that pretty well everybody in the crew was so sick, and by this time two guys were dead already. It happened so fast. It happened so fast that one guy they took to the hospital, and they couldn't even get the pump into his stomach.
Did the Japanese not try and warn you at all about
it? They didn't know that we were stealing it. See, this was strictly on our own. And turned out, after this all cooled off 2 days later, the Japanese medical doctor did come in the camp, and he said what we drank was de-icing fluid for high-flying planes. And there was a little glycol in it, and this is what made us think it was alcohol.
Yeah. And the milk is what saved
The milk is what saved the three of us. Because we were the first ones to throw it out and up, and we just threw it up. And the reaction of the milk and this wood alcohol and poison, whatever was in there, just reacted so fast that we got rid of it out of our stomach so fast.
Yeah.
And that was 10 days before the war was over. 10 days later, we found out that the war was over.
Did you have rumors? Did you have access to newspapers or anything?
No, we got no news. We had no access. The only news we got is the odd rumor that we could squeeze out of the Japs. And towards the end, but the last 6 months, there would be the odd prisoner come in. We had one American flyer came in, and he was captured in the Burma Road area. And he told us the latest news that he knew. But he had, the time that he was captured and the time he came to our camp, had been a year elapsed. So the news he gave us that they were going to make a drive on Manila. The Americans were thinking of taking back Manila. But the big Pacific sea battle hadn't taken place then yet. So it was all old news that we got anyway. And but as far as news is concerned, no, we got none. Mm-hmm. Nothing that we could really count on. The only thing is with rumors that these guys would bring in, and then from there on we would put two and two together, and half the time it was wrong anyway.
Was your shipyard bombed near the end of the war?
Our shipyards?
Yeah.
Yeah, we This was about June, I think, our shipyard started getting bombed. About April, the troops start coming in, troop carriers start coming in with Japanese war material and troops. And they wouldn't let us, once one of their warships came in, one of their troop ships, they wouldn't let us on the dock. We would go to another dock. And they would clear their ship, and then the ship would go out again. And then a couple of small, maybe you call it a cruiser type, a warship would come in the dock. And it sat in dock for about 3 months. And when the Americans started bombing, they went for this ship. And that was, I guess that was about the only thing valuable in the city that we were in as far as their defenses is concerned, is going after this ship. And they did get it eventually, but we never got bombed heavy. The only bombing we did is get strafed and from light bombers from aircraft, or from aircraft carriers.
Were you a little frightened when there was shelling in that, or when there was bombing that you were going to be one of your Allied casualties?
We were worried about who was going to get it, yeah. Like, we'd going home, we'd say, well, that was a close one, and then we'd talk amongst ourselves, you take it cool, and don't you start getting brave. When the siren goes, you hit for the first corner you can find. Well, I'd always go, like, we were doing a lot of boxcars around and railroad cars, I'd always go throw myself in between the rails, eh? I found that as safe as any. And we keep saying to ourselves, let's not be any heroes, and stand and wave at them as they're going by, because when they start scraping, they come down pretty low. Because they would never recognize you as an ally anyway. Yeah. So this is about the only thing that we worried about, is who's going to get it, and let's not be any heroes. Getting close. So when the end finally did come, it kind of came, we kind of knew it was coming, suspected it was coming. Like, we went through an industry area. When we walked to work, we went through an industry area, and there was blast furnaces and machinery galore. There's one section we went through, there'd be about at least 8 blast furnaces right facing the road where we'd go, and the weather wasn't there that cold, so most of their foundries were all they had is a roof on them, and their sides would be wide open. It wouldn't be like in this country, everything would be closed in. And those blast furnaces, they went 365 days a year. They never shut down. Never seen those furnaces shut down all the time we were there. So that morning when we went to work, those furnaces were going full blast. But you didn't see too many employees around. And we went to work, and even the guards, they were mum. They wouldn't say much, they wouldn't holler at you, they wouldn't tell you to, if you wandered over to the other side of the road, they wouldn't say boo. They were quite meek. And when we got to work, they didn't know what to put us on. Didn't know what work there was for us. The time we got to work, it was maybe 10 o'clock, we'd been sitting around. Well, this is fine with us, we love this. But we thought that they were so unorganized that we knew there was something on. So, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they come up and they said, they come up and said, we're going back to camp. And, then we went back to camp, and all the blast furnaces were off. That was the first time in the 2.5 or 3 years we were there, seeing those furnaces off. It was dead. So we knew there was something going on. And when we got to camp, the guys already were on the, more or less in the parade square where you lined up to get counted every day. They were already standing there waiting for us. And when we got there, they lined us up. And the camp commander came out and he says that the war wasn't over, that the Americans and the Japanese were. Then he got on his bicycle and he took off as fast as he could take off. Well, that was enough for us. And we went after him. The guards disappeared and we just opened the gates wide. And by this time, this was about 2 in the afternoon, about 5 in the afternoon. It was just getting dusk. An American fighter plane came over. And he came over across the camp and he threw his boot down, taking his boot off his foot and put a half a pack of cigarettes in the boot and put a note in and said, "Sorry, boys, this is all I got. We'll be back." And before dark, B-29s came back and they dropped food to us. But they just took a great big 45-gallon drum and cut the top out and nailed it shut with a wooden top and tied a parachute to it and dropped her. That was the end of the war. And then we were still in camp for about 2 weeks, but there was nothing stopping us. We just roamed the city in Niigata just like if it was ours. They didn't lay a hand on us. They never tried. They were shit scared of us.
Did you get any revenge after the war was over, or was it sort of past the point of that?
Yeah, we got a little revenge, but that's one point I don't want to talk about. It was one there that didn't live to tell the tale. But other than that, we were more or less looking for a good time. But when once we get our stomachs full, and we had all kinds of Red Cross blankets, we had all kinds of food galore, chocolate bar, cigarettes, chocolate, chewing gum, you name it. Mm-hmm. And we went downtown for a good time. Until the Americans came in and stopped us and took us to Yokohama. And from Yokohama, they segregated us for help. And some went home on a hospital ship and some went home just on an ordinary transport carrier.
Did you have any trouble when you started eating American food again with
I had trouble when the planes came over and started throwing their K-rations to us. I mean, we just gouged ourselves. But we gouged ourselves, most of the guys gouged themselves so much that they were sick.
Yeah.
And they'd throw up. But as far as I think their normal body reaction, I don't know of any that had too much trouble. Mm-hmm. But the only thing I would think is some of them had problem because they, with the vitamins, their vitamin deficiency, what we did have, and then getting the high concentrated vitamins, I think in a lot of cases it was too much for them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because vitamin deficiency was the big problem there. Because our diet was rice.
Did you have talk to men who said that they went nearly blind from vitamin deficiencies?
A very good friend of mine, in fact, this Roland Duby that I was talking about that helped to steal that milk, he is getting 100% pension now for being blind. But he's not 100% blind. I mean, he can still walk without a cane. But it has improved, but at one time he had to use the white cane. But I've heard the doctors talk about him too. I mean, there might be a little problem about this drinking of this glycol that could have affected him too. Now, was it the vitamin deficiency or was it this glycol that we drank? That could have affected him.
So did you go to Manila, or did you get straight back?
No, we went straight from Yokohama to Honolulu. And from Honolulu, we went to San Francisco. And from San Francisco, we went to Victoria. And from Victoria, we came home. I landed back in Winnipeg on the 9th of October, 1945.
Pretty happy time when you finally got
home. Happened to be my birthday, too.
You got back on your birthday?
Oh, I got back on my birthday, on the 9th of October.
Did you have any, like after so long in a prison camp, was there any feeling that even though it was a hell hole, it was some place that you'd been, was it hard to tear yourself away?
It wasn't hard to tear yourself away from it, but the hell hole, it stuck with most of the guys for a long time. My wife tells me, it's still with me now, today. She says, I dream about it. I get vicious dreams at night about it. Mm-hmm. Mind you, which I don't, can't contradict her or say yes or no, because I don't remember. Mm-hmm. I don't think, sometimes I say, well, no, this is not true. I'd wake up in the middle of one of them, but I apparently don't. Mm-hmm. But she says, I have some hellish dreams. Shooting Japs all over the place.
Do you have any other bad effects?
No, I'm very fortunate, you know. I am one of the healthiest guys in the Hong Kong veterans. You know, my only problem is I had a sore back. I got hurt over there on a shipyard on my back. And when I came back, my back bothered me. And then I got an operation. I had a back disc operated on in 1951. And my back is bothering me now. And then I got varicose veins over there, which I just got operated on at Christmas time, and the varicose veins got so bad that they started blood clot in them, and I got phlebitis in them, and I got that operated on this Christmas. Other than that, I got a good stomach. I eat everything. I drink everything. I never had a toothache in my life. I never had an earache in my life. I still got all my teeth.
You did better than
this. So I haven't got much to complain about, really, as far as health is concerned.
Did you get a pension for your back?
I'm getting a pension.
Did you have to fight for that?
I got a 10% pension right off the start when I got discharged. Mm-hmm. And there was no way I could get that pension increased. And I got my pension increased at the time when they had this brother survey. Ottawa came out and said, well, we're going to have a brother survey, and then from there on we're going to start making up our minds. And then they came out and they said, well, all the Hong Kong veterans are going to 1967, when they came out and said that this is on the board. The Woods Commission recommended this is what should happen. Well, then I got called in for my rebore, and after the rebore I jumped right up to 70% right after that. But that was 2 years. That was 20 years, 22 years after we were back. But that was 2 years before this 50% pension came in effect, which I had a 2 year jump on this 50%. But there was still 20 years late coming. A lot of our guys, you probably interviewed a few of the boys that are quite bitter about this pension deal. I'm not that bitter, really, about it.
Well, you're still able to work, though. You're healthy enough that you're still able to work.
A lot of those other guys are, too. This is a sickness. I got to agree with you. It's an ailment. But a lot of guys got that in their head. They don't want to work, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess...
And they're making them sick, and they're going to be bound, come hell or high water, they're going to get their 100% pension, and they're going to quit work. Well, it's not that easy to come by.
Yeah, I guess
it's 100% pension is not that easy to come by. But I always maintain I'll sooner be healthy and work, and they can shove their pensions. But I'm lucky. I'm getting my 70%. And I've still got a fair job. I'm faring out pretty good. My health is better than most of them.
You can answer this or not, but after your experiences, what do you think of war, the whole thing that you went through? Was it worth the fighting?
You'll never get me in another one.
That was enough.
You'll never get me. Mind you, they never want me again. I'm too old. But there is no way.
No way.
I would never encourage him to go, no. I would never encourage him. Mind you, I wouldn't if, mind you, I haven't got a son. Mm-hmm. But if I had a son and he says, well, I'm going to join the army, I would try and stop him the best way I knew how, just verbally, try and discourage him. But I would never say, no, I'll disown you if you go or something like that. No. I mean, once, I think any child comes of age, I think they got their own mind.
Yeah.
I couldn't have been stopped. Nobody could have stopped me from going. I wouldn't want to stop anybody else.
Yeah.
But I sure as heck ain't going to encourage them to go. especially to Vietnam.
Yeah.
Especially in Asia, what we have no business fighting about. We know nothing about the country in the first place. This flea-fested country. What, do you want to go and fight for that godforsaken hole?
Is that a reflection of Hong Kong, or is that just...
Well, I just got an idea what things are like over there.
Yeah.
And I just feel that... why go and fight for a country that there's nothing there?
Yeah.
Are you fighting communism or are you fighting something else? Communism, I mean, you can fight communism if the government wants to fight communism. There are a lot better ways than fighting it with rifles.
Yeah.
Is the way I look at it.
Yeah, I think maybe you're right there.
But I would never say to a guy, don't go. This is against my belief. This is not quite true, but I would never encourage you to go.
Well, that's all we have to ask. We might have missed something, thinking if there's anything you want to add.
No, I think that's pretty well all. I know. I don't know if I did you any good or if I did anything valuable there, but... the only thing that is really valuable there that other guys probably ain't talking too much about is there's only very few of us left that were in this drinking contest, what we call it, which we had five guys, I think, that died. It was Mike Hawes. It was... Bobby Collins, Jimmy Gard, and Wagner. Four of them died on that drinking spree.